that book taught me not only how to write, but the book taught me also how to live. So the first book I wrote was one that almost no one has heard of because it never got published. And almost all writers of books, and especially novelists, have what are called trunk books or trunk novels. And that's because it stays in a trunk for the rest of your life, never gets published, with good reason, because usually they're terrible. And my first one was the best novel ever written, I thought, when I was 26 or 27. And it's pretty terrible. Nonetheless, when I was in my 20s, early 20s, someone had told me, you're not a real writer till you've written a million words. And so I was trying to write a lot, because writing is a craft, just like making shoes or just like growing plants or just like any other. And so I was learning the craft, and one of the things I was doing that I don't hear about writers doing often enough, but I do hear about painters doing this, and I hear about people in other crafts doing this, is I was doing a lot of copying. So I would read some novel specifically looking for how did the writer do that. And then when I found something I especially liked, I would hand copy it, and then I would change it just enough to, here's an example. I remember reading something by Raymond Chandler when I was in my 20s. It was a description of a woman. And so I just hand copied. It was a very, very good description. And I hand copied it. And then after that, I, was going to change it a little bit, but do it again with my modifications. So I went to the post office, and the clerk was behind the counter. And when I got home, I wrote a description following pretty much word for word what Chandler had done, except substituting this clerk for the secretary he was describing. And one of the things I discovered there is that when he was describing her, what she looked like, it wasn't random. It was, he started at the hairline, and he moved down, describe her eyebrows, her eyes, her cheeks, her mouth, her chin. So the point is, he was moving in one direction. He wasn't hopping around. I didn't know that. And, you know, just like learning how to use a hammer, you have to learn how to use words. And so about that time, I was reading a book by James Herriot, one of those all creatures, great and small, all things bright and beautiful. And one of the stories I read was maybe 7 or 8 or 9 pages long, 10 pages long. It was very short. And it was about this guy who would go into a bar every day, and his dog would hop up on the bar stool next to him. And the dog was his only friend. And then one day the dog died, and the man was disconsolate and killed himself. And when I finished, I was just sobbing for the last, you know, several pages of the book. And the first thing I did, I was sobbing. And then after that, I was kind of outraged because of how sort of grossly manipulative the story was to get me to sob within 10 pages. And then after that, I was marveling at, oh my gosh, how did he do that? In just 10 pages, he got me to go from being, you know, being perfectly content, sitting here in the North Idaho sunshine in the summer, reading a book and perfectly happy, to just sobbing my eyes out, 10 pages. How did you do that? I want to do that. So I was going to write a story, and the story was going to be, there's a guy who lives in a town, and he doesn't have any friends, and he has a dog who's his only friend, and then the dog dies, and then because the dog dies, well, he wasn't going to kill himself because I was a coward, and instead he was going to move out of town. It would have been just a dreadful story. But so I'm trying to write this story, and I can't do it, and it's just going nowhere. And then meanwhile, I had become friends with this family in the town where I lived in North Idaho and become friends with the older man, Don, and then also his daughter. And we'd become friends the previous year, and she lived in another town, another state. And then she came back up to visit her family because her husband had been put in jail for beating and raping her. And she was then with her family, and we had a lot of talks about that. And I spent one night up until about 4 a.m. talking to my friend's mother, Betty's mother, about how can we help Betty to leave? She was going to go back to her husband, and how can we get her to stay? What can we do? And we talked until, like I said, 4 or 5 a.m. And then I went home and went to sleep, and I woke up about 7, and I had the idea for a short story in my mind, and I was going to not sleep until I finished the short story. It's going to be 7 or 8 pages. And the short story was that there's this guy in the town, and he has a dog, and the dog is his only friend. And then he becomes friends with this woman who is in an abusive relationship, and the husband gets jealous of that abusive relationship, gets jealous of the friendship between the woman and the guy with the dog. And so he kills the dog, and then the guy leaves town, and and that is the sort of final trigger that causes the woman to grow to love herself enough to give him the boot to move out. And we're going to come back to this in a second. So I was going to write the book in a day, or not the book, the short story in a day. And I wrote the first 7 pages, and then I realized, nah, it's probably about 15 pages. And so I'm not going to finish it today. And the next day I got to page 15 and realized it's probably going to be about 30. And by the time I got to page 30, I realized it's going to be about 60. And then it ended up being a 200-page novel, which eventually was sent out to 112 publishers. And I got 112 no's and finally got the message on that. But there are a few things that I want to say about this book. One of them is that it taught me so much about writing, and my hope is that it can teach some people about writing and about life. That one thing is that up until then, writing had been really, really difficult. And the thing I found with that book is that the reason it had been difficult before is because I was writing for practice. And this basically was a 200-page letter to a dear friend begging her to not go back to her husband, as novel was. And there's a difference between writing for writing's sake and a difference between that and writing because you have something you desperately need to communicate. And if you don't communicate, it will never be communicated. And so I was on fire. And one of the things I learned is that there are multiple places that writing can come from. And when the writing comes from me, it's actually really hard to write. And when the writing comes from the muse, when it comes from that source, then it's really easy. And this ties back in with, you know, when I was a high jumper, one of the things I knew very well was that if on the best jumps, you don't feel anything at all because all of your body's motion is headed in the same direction. There is no resistance. And when something is really right, it flows really smoothly. Yeah, that doesn't mean that, I mean, obviously a novel I write now is better than a novel I wrote 20 years ago. I mean, you can be a better writer and that comes into it, but I have found the one thing I can tell is whether the writing is coming from that source or whether the writing is coming from me. And the writing that's coming from me, I usually discard because it's not any good. So one of the things that I learned in this book is that the real writing, I learned what it feels like to find that place. So writing is really, really hard, except when it's really easy. And the difficult thing is finding the place where it's easy, finding that door. And so for me, really from 1987 to 1997 was, yeah, learning more of the craft of writing, but also it was learning how to find that door, learning how to find that spring from which the writing flows. And that is intimately associated with having something desperately important or that you feel is desperately important to communicate. So another thing about this book that I'm glad the book didn't get published, frankly, because A, it wasn't that good. The first chapter is still quite good, but the rest of it is not as good. And another reason I'm glad that the book was never published is because, you know, Joseph Campbell talked about how he spent his 20s practicing writing so that when he was in his 30s and had something to say, he would know how to write so he could say it well. And, you know, there are some traditional societies where nobody under the age of 30 is really allowed to talk. And I think that there is, I think that one hopes that people, by the time they get to be in their 30s and 40s and 50s, they are more mature in their philosophies than in their 20s. And there's one example from the book that really stands out. That is one reason that I'm glad the book didn't get published. Is I wrote the book, I set it in a town I lived in Nevada called Carlin, Nevada. And I lived there for a couple of years. And when I was there, I encountered this guy who lived a couple blocks from where I did, who had some books written about him. He was called Rolling Thunder. And, he is what we now would call a fake Indian. And he attracted, sort of a lot of ex-hippies and certain, some new agers. And everybody in town, because it was a tiny, tiny, tiny little town, the people in town, the old timers, knew his real story. It's a very tragic story, which was that he was, just a regular guy. And then, one day, the story went, I don't know if this is actually true, but this was the gossip all around town I heard from multiple people, is that one day he had been cleaning a carburetor using gasoline on his front porch. And then something happened and it caught fire. And, he tried to get in the house to save his family, but they burned to death. And that, affected him strongly, and he disappeared for a while. And when he came back, he was Rolling Thunder. That's the story we heard. And don't get mad at me for this. The book was never published, and I'm glad it wasn't published. But in the book, I have him as a very, very minor character. And I explore it a little bit, but I was in my 20s and I was stupid. And I sort of came to the attitude of, you know, if somebody believes they are something, then maybe they are. And of course the word for that is delusion. And the word for that is appropriation. And just because a white guy thinks he's an Indian does not actually make him an Indian. But I was too young and stupid to understand that yet. And this of course has ramifications all over for, you know, anybody who believes they are something they are not. But that's, I just wanted to mention that as a sideline that, you know, I'm glad actually that I didn't get any books published in my 20s. And I don't like to read many novels or nonfiction written by people in their 20s, because quite often people in their 20s have not really, they don't really understand the world. One hopes that people understand the world better later. So those are some of the stories I wanted to tell about the writing of that novel. The main thing I wanted to hit was that it taught me, you know, Amy Tan, I believe it was, somebody asked her in an interview once, does the writing ever get any easier? And she responded, no, but it gets better. And that's clearly her experience, and she's clearly a very experienced writer. But my experience is very different. If writing was still as hard as it was in my 20s, I wouldn't be a writer. As it does become easier for me to find the ability to listen to the muse does become easier to hear the muse with experience. I think part of what I'm getting at with this, and part of the reason I wanted to tell this whole story, is that we know in our hearts when something is true, and we know in our hearts when something is right. And all of my writing up to that point had been practice, but this was the first true thing I ever wrote, the first thing that was a true attempt to communicate something. You know, one of my favorite quotes is by the writer Charles Johnson, who says that the writing he really wants to read is writing where if somebody put a gun to the writer's head and said, "I'm going to kill you as soon as you write the last word or the last sentence or the last paragraph or the last page," then the writer's not going to lie. And the writer is going to deliver what would be their final testament to the world. He said, that's the sort of writing I want to read. And that's what this book did for me, is it was the first time that I wrote something that wasn't for practice, that was an honest attempt to communicate. And if somebody would have shot me when the book was done, that'd be fine. And that's how I've treated every book since, is that when I'm working on a book, my deal with the universe is always, I can't die till this book's over. Because if I don't say this, nobody ever will. And then once the book's done, yeah, okay, you can go ahead and take me. And, you know, I got a couple months before I start the next book, so this is your window. And that applies to every area of our lives. That applies to what you do for your vocation. It applies to how you take care of your loved ones. It applies to your relationships. You know, there's that great line about, if you have to ask, it ain't jazz. And it's the same thing, that book taught me not only how to write, but the book taught me also how to live. That I want to live with that same being on fire that I was for the 6 months it took me to write that book. And I look forward to discussing variations on this theme in the other books that I've written, and how they have fit or not fit with that, and the things that I learned from each book, with the hope that, you know, I've long said that one of the reasons I write is to attempt to articulate the things that I know in my heart to be true, but to which I've not yet put words. And in so doing, I hope to help other people to articulate the things that they know in their hearts are true, but to which they've not yet put words. And my hope is that with this series, we can do some of that as well.